NCAA has been looking into allegations raised last fall that Michigan players practiced or spent time on football-related activities beyond NCAA limits. Michigan is seeing how its internal investigation matches up with the NCAA findings and will consider implementing sanctions. Illinois tries to stick close to the Big Ten leaders tonight as it visits Michigan at 9-5. The Illini trail 11-3 Purdue by two games. Michigan State and Ohio State are each 11-4. Wisconsin is 10-5 in conference play. The Chicago Cubs are having their first full squad workout of spring training today, and there's a big question in the outfield. Alfonso Soriano says he doesn't know when he'll be ready to run full speed after having knee surgery in September. He says he's been taking batting practice with no pain. And the U.S. women's hockey team has stormed into the gold medal game at the Olympics. Monique Lamoureux's hat trick sparked a 9-1 win over Sweden in the semifinal game. Jesse Vetter was only called on to make 11 saves as the U.S. earned its fourth straight win. The Team USA will play powerhouse Canada in Thursday's championship game. That's sports.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting Immortal Classics on Friday, March 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Krannert Center. Pianist Chufang Huang will perform Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 1 in F-sharp minor, Opus 1.
Well, once you've got your fancy new TV and you're ready to download a movie or your favorite TV show, you face the question of how much you will pay. Apple is shaking up the media world with plans to cut the price it charges for network TV shows sold through iTunes. Here's NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
The first shoe to drop came last week when CBS said it may offer shows as a test for 99 cents per episode. They currently go for $1.99 on iTunes. But other network execs are reportedly skeptical. Michael McGuire, a media analyst at Gartner Research, says TV bosses are having to weigh the value of their content and the size of the iTunes customer base.
There is a pretty big number Apple has in its favor. Over 150 million active credit cards on account.
Among the questions currently up for debate, how does a 99 cents per episode price structure pay for actors, writers, and directors? And how many consumers will pay for a TV program they can already stream for free, although with commercials, on sites like Hulu? On the other hand, says McGuire, it's unclear how many viewers will pay for cable if prices drop.
As broadband penetration increases, I think you're going to see more and more consumers looking at their pay TV bills and saying, yes, I have 600 channels, but I really only watch 5 or 10. Can I just pay for the 5 or 10?
And McGuire says that's when the older distribution models like network and cable TV begin to show their age. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
A sportswear company from China has set up shop in Nike's backyard. Nike has long been America's king of sports shoes and other sports gear. It got there in part by outsourcing to countries such as China. Now, some of what China has learned may pose a challenge to Nike's dominance, as we hear in this report from Oregon Public Broadcasting's Christian Foden-Wenzel.
China's most successful athletic company, Li Ning, cut the ribbon on its first U.S. store this month in Portland. Outside, Tim Sayersing waited to see Baron Davis of the L.A. Clippers.
On this website I go onto, it's called Sneaker Files. Sneaker Files shows what like brand shoes it got. I know Baron has it, some other guy in the NBA wearing his shoes. I think his name's Damon Jones. And they all wear this gear, and this gear's going to be sick, right?
You can hear the excitement in his voice. But generating that kind of buzz hasn't happened overnight. It started at the 1984 Olympics. That's when founder and company namesake Li Ning won 6 medals.
Part of his aspiration while standing on the podium, receiving his gold medals, is he looked down his chest and he saw a foreign brand.
Jay Lee is the company's top dog here in the U.S. He says Li Ning sportswear can now be found in 6,000 stores in China. But he says Nike and Adidas don't need to worry. Li Ning hasn't come to the U.S. to take over. It's here to learn. But Li Ning's already well-versed in the importance of global marketing. Remember this music? It's from the 2008 Olympics in China. Now try and remember the scene. An athlete flying through the air on a wire to light the torch. You there? Well, that athlete was Li Ning, And you can bet your favorite pair of running shoes, the Chinese audience wasn't thinking about the official sponsor, Adidas. It was thinking about Li Ning. So, cut to today in Nike's hometown, Portland, Oregon, a city awash in Nike shoe designers, running scientists, and global marketeers, many of whom Jay Lee is happy to hire.
Given the available talent pool that's here in Portland, it gives us a much closer and easier access to those talents.
I don't see anything wrong. I actually look at the opportunity as just that.
Eric Miller is one of 26 apparel designers Li Ning's hired.
I think the marketplace, whether it be shoes or cars or computers and electronics, anything, is pretty much an international market now.
But before Li Ning can truly become an international company, there's a problem. Chinese sports like ping pong don't exactly get Americans stripping off their shirts and painting their faces with passion. So in the new store, table tennis phenom Brian Loader is also a salesman.
If I'm going to try getting somebody into table tennis, I'm also going to want them to, you know, try to experiment with good equipment too. You know, if you give somebody a bad paddle, a bad pair of shoes, bad anything in any sport, they're not going to enjoy it as much.
Other Li Ning employees do the same for badminton, tai chi, and kung fu. But is it going to work?
I look at China and Li Ning specifically as having an incredible engine.
Gary Peck runs a company that designs products for the likes of Nike and New Balance. He says Chinese companies may have a reputation for plastic throwaway stuff and being bureaucratic, but
things do evolve and things do change, and if they're prepared to do that, then I think they're going to be very successful.
For its part, Nike says it doesn't take any competitor lightly. But over the last few years, Li Ning's averaged an annual growth rate of 37%, stats that are likely to keep Nike up on its well-conditioned toes for a while. For NPR News, I'm Christian Fodenwenzel in Portland.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This evening, the city of Urbana will hold a meeting to set goals for the city's farmers market, Market at the Square. The city is hoping community residents and patrons will attend, as will vendors, performers, community groups, as well as elected officials. This session is the first of three meetings that will explore long-range plans for Market at the Square. This evening's meeting begins at 6 o'clock at the Urbana Civic Center, which is located downtown at 108 East Water Street. The event is free, and the public is very much encouraged to attend. Lisa Braltz is director for Urbana's Market at the Square, and she joins me this afternoon to tell us what her hopes are for this evening's meeting. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Market at the Square is one of the state's largest and best attended farmers markets, and it is quite an asset for the city. So why is the city taking a look at the market at this point in time?
Well, actually, I've gotten some phone calls from people very alarmed asking if there was a problem, you know, and is that why we're having this meeting? And I really want to emphasize that these public input meetings and this planning process aren't happening because there's any trouble. In fact, it's the opposite. The market has grown substantially, particularly in the last 5 years, and there's never been a long-range plan for it. We don't have a mission statement or even a vision statement in terms of how we want to manage that growth. So these meetings are really about sort of figuring out what the public and our stakeholders are interested in on all kinds of levels, everything from the small little, you know, issues that come up every time I'm out at the market to much larger big issues like changing location. Is that something that will be part of our future? Things like that. So it is really time to have this long range planning process.
So what kind of questions are you asking about the market? What kinds of things do you have in mind for tonight's session?
Well, the way that it'll be structured is I will give a Market 101 presentation to the group, I hope there's a lot of people there, that basically will cover the market's history, the role of the city, the role of the director, some highlights from 2009, just to give people sort of a working knowledge of how the market works. After that, we'll break off into smaller groups where facilitators will try to encourage conversation by asking some pretty specific questions, just like, do you attend the market, you know, on a regular basis? If so, how regularly do you come? Why don't you come? Are there any barriers to your participation mm-hmm. or to getting there. But we're also interested in teasing out exactly some of the larger issues. How do you see the market? How do you see what role do you see the market playing in the community next year, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? We're interested in those much larger questions as well. So there'll be some discussion on that. And if we get the mix of people that we're hoping for, I imagine it will be quite a vigorous conversation.
Yeah. One of the ways that I've seen the market change in recent years is that there's a community element that is there in terms of informing people about programs, about opportunities for joining in community groups. CU Fit Families has been very active recently at the market in terms of talking about, you know, getting kids to ride bicycles right. and walking to work and walking to school and that kind of thing. Is that, in fact, the case that that's been one of the ways that the market's grown in the recent past?
Yes. When the city took the market over in the late 90s, that's when I think the city saw the market as an opportunity to draw more people downtown to participate, not just at the market, but to patronize shops and mm-hmm. go to the library and do all those other things. But they also saw it as a way to engage the community. And that's when the community groups and also the performers really started to become a much larger part of the market. So I would say that that is definitely, and just in the last year, the participation of community groups grew by almost 5% at the market. There were days that we had to turn people away because we ran out of room. There are a lot of organizations that really like the exposure that they get at the market. You know, when we average around 6,000 attendees per weekend, that's getting your message out in front of a lot of people. So I would say, yes, that community engagement piece is definitely a part of our growth.
Do you have a sense of what issues the next two meetings will explore, or will you let this evening's meeting lead you into the next planning
session?
Well,
we know that the next meeting will be stakeholder-driven, where we will be interviewing certain groups of people, whether they're business owners or vendors, market patrons who are really invested in the market, really trying to get, based on the information that we gather today, trying to get more specific stakeholder-type information. After that, there will be another, a third much larger public meeting, kind of like the one that we're having tonight. So, and this is all happening over the next couple of months, you know, couple, 3 months, right up until the market begins, which is on May 1st.
Have you set dates for the follow-up sessions?
I don't have exact dates yet. I will have them I'll have them really soon. We have a steering committee that is sort of driving how these meetings are being run, and we'll decide at our next steering committee meeting how soon we'll have that next public input session.
As director of Urbana's market, you've got to be interested in what's happening elsewhere in the country. Are there things that you've seen that would be worth considering and talking about in our community that you've seen elsewhere in the country in terms of what farmers markets are doing?
Well, farmers markets, and actually I'll cover this briefly in Market 101 tonight. Farmers markets have grown in number 13% in 1 year, according to the USDA. So it's not just our market that's popular. They're popular all over the country. And as a director, I'm on listservs and I communicate frequently with other market directors. And so sometimes it's really hard not to have market envy because of things that are happening in other places. There are times when I will look at markets, for example, that have indoor-outdoor structures that enable them to go to extend their season or to protect people from the elements. I think things like that are kind of like, wow, wouldn't it be really cool?
Well, you've done that to a certain extent, have you?
When the Urbana Business Association takes over the market
right,
in November,
okay.
then yes, it does move indoors. But that it's a change in management, so it's a change mm-hmm. a little bit in philosophy and how it's run and things like that. But then I look at where our location now, and I think, you know, we have really great visibility. We've been in or near that location for almost 30 years. So part of me too wants to be able to maximize what we're doing where we're at. So I look at other markets and think that would be really cool. But because the city runs the market, it's a unique situation. Most markets are not run by municipalities or run mm-hmm. by nonprofits. So we're in a little bit of a different situation. And so I'm anxious to see how it all plays out, really. I think the feedback from the community will be really important for our direction.
Now, will the information gleaned from these planning sessions be put into play for the upcoming market?
Very, very doubtful.
Okay.
This is more, we'll still be taking public comments on our final presentation into May and June, I expect. So some things may be implemented, but I think since it's really a blueprint that's being created, many of the changes will go into place for the 2011 season.
Okay. When does Market at the Square open? 2010.
2010. We open on May 1st. Coming right up. It's about 9 weeks away.
How many vendors take part at the height of the season?
Oh, at the height of the season, when we are completely full, I think our maximum vendor day last year was about 95 vendors, which is quite significant. We had a registered total of almost 180 last year.
Okay. Now, if somebody can't come out this evening, I would imagine that you're happy to take letters or email.
Absolutely. We will have the survey questions that we'll be asking tonight on our website tomorrow. So if they go to the City of Urbana website, they'll be able to access those questions. We encourage people to print them out and mail them back to us. Look at the questions and fire off an email to myself or to Rebecca Bird, who's from our planning division, who I'm doing this exercise with, to call us. That's fine. All of our information is on our website. But we really want people to feel like they can participate even if they're not there.
Okay. So this evening, the City of Urbana will hold a meeting to set long-range goals for the city's farmers market, Market at the Square. The session is the first of three meetings that will explore long-range plans for Market at the Square. This evening's meeting begins at 6 o'clock at the Urbana Civic Center, located downtown at 108 East Water Street, 108 East Water Street. The event is free, and the public is encouraged to attend. And my thanks this afternoon to Lisa Braltz, Director for Urbana's Market at the Square.
And thanks to WILL for all your support.
Earth and Sky.
The most important thing to know about the Earth's ice sheets is that they are changing, that they are responding to climate change.
You're listening to Dr. Jay Zwally, project scientist on NASA's ICESat mission. Since 2003, ICESat has used lasers to precisely measure the thickness of ice near Earth's poles. Zwally said that over the past decade, Greenland's ice sheet has lost more ice than it's gained. He said it's losing more than 150 gigatons of ice every year.
One way to think about how much 150 gigatons is, if you had earth movers that carried 150 tons each, it would take 2,000 of them each minute to dump the excess ice into the ocean.
Dr. Zwally also spoke of sea level rise.
The amount of sea level rise currently is about 3 to 4 millimeters per year. So even if there is no additional climate warming, sea level will continue at the same rate and rise about 16 inches over the next 100 years.
The lasers that monitored ice thickness on ICESat stopped working in 2009. An airborne campaign called Operation Ice Bridge is currently bridging the gap in observations until the launch of the ICESat 2 satellite in 2015. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's programs are made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting the classic comedy, Father of the Bride, from Wednesday.